If you like Area 45, you're going to enjoy the Hoover Institution's other podcasts, Uncommon Knowledge, The Classicist with Victor Davis Hanson, and The Libertarian with Richard Epstein. Subscribe now to the Hoover Podcast at hoover.org/podcasts. That's hoover.org/podcasts. Hoover Podcast, ideas defining a free society. Hello, it's Friday, March the 6th, and welcome to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast examining the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. I'm Bill Whalen, a Hoover Research Fellow and the Virginia Hobbs Carpenter Fellow in Journalism. My guest today here in our recording studio on the campus of Stanford University is Dr. David Brady. Dave Brady is the Davies Family Senior Fellow Emeritus here at the Hoover Institution. He is also a political scientist extraordinaire. He's published 7 books and more than 100 papers in journals and books. Dave Brady also writes frequently on American politics. He and his colleague Brett Parker write very insightful data-driven analyses for Real Clear Politics. I emphasize that word data-driven because we're going to talk about data today rather than rank speculation. Dave, thanks for doing the podcast in such short notice.
Sure.
So I mentioned data, and I want to get into that quickly, and I think we should have a conversation about what happened, because here we sit in 2016, and the feeling is kind of like, well, those of us who talk about politics and say things with such certainty, we're kind of lying on our backs right now like Charlie Brown after he whiffed on the football. In 2016, we talked with such certainty about Hillary Clinton being the inevitable president in waiting. In 2016, Dave, we talked about Donald Trump being entirely unelectable. And in 2020, what we talked about with certainty, the rise of socialism. Bernie Sanders is the Democrats' front-runner, the certainty of the first brokered convention in the United States since 1952. And then South Carolina voted. And then 14 states went to the polls on Super Tuesday and American Samoa, and they voted. And now what does the Democratic race look like? Joe Biden has a nominal lead in delegates. We're still counting in California. Maybe that changes somewhat. But Biden now appears to be the front runner, appears to be his race to lose now. And Bernie, barring a surprise turnaround in Michigan, it looks like he once again is destined to be the bridesmaid. So we can sit here for the next 45 minutes, Dave, and engage in theories as to what happened. Did Joe Biden find his groove? Was Bernie Sanders maybe an overrated commodity? If you look at his numbers in Iowa and New Hampshire, did Democrats come home? Did the media do Joe Biden a favor by giving him a really good run after Super Tuesday, showing rallying events and unity events and so forth? Instead, let's talk about the data which you're holding in your hand. Tell me what we have learned about the Democratic Party going into South Carolina and after South Carolina.
So my read on this is that if you look at the Democrats, you shouldn't think of them as just liberals and moderates, or liberals and moderate conservative. I break it down three ways: very liberal, liberal, and moderate to conservative. And so the people, first thing that happened that you think about, start with the Obama administration, too. So there's a rift in the party. Mm-hmm. There's a difference between what the left want, very liberal want, and what the moderates and conservatives want. Obama was able to kind of patch that over. But over time, over the past 2008 to 2020, the very liberal and Democratic Party have increased by 14%, so about 26%. The liberals are down about 4 points, mm-hmm. So they're about 32 points. And the moderates and conservatives are down by 11, but they still constitute 38% of the party. And so how do they differ? The very liberal, so it always falls in order, very liberal the most, and then to moderate. The very liberal make more money. Mm-hmm. They are better educated. They're whiter. So 71% of Democrats who say they're very liberal are white, 67% of liberals, and only 52% of moderates to conservatives. Their religion is 41% of people who are moderate conservatives say religion is very important, and among very liberals, only 18. They're just some differences. In regard to abortion, always, like, I'm just going to, for purposes, I'll just do the very liberals and the moderates, and mm-hmm. the liberals are always in the middle. Abortion always legal. 67% are very liberal. Yes. Yeah. Moderates, 37%. Favor the death penalty, 24-54. Gay marriage, 97% of very liberal favor gay marriage. 58% of moderates and conservatives. Here's a good one. Democratic Party is not liberal enough. You ask a question. Very liberal people, 54% say that's right. It's not liberal enough. If you ask liberals, 21% say that. Mm-hmm. You ask moderate conservatives, it's 4%. So there are huge differences. So if we just pop the contemporary issues. Medicare for all with no private insurance, very liberal, 68%. Moderates, 31. Current health care needs to be completely rebuilt. Mm-hmm. 48% of very liberal agree strongly with that. 19% of conservatives. And I could go on.
Sure.
But the bottom line, support the Green New Deal, same thing. Very liberal support it. Moderates, 7% of moderates say we support that. So what happens is if you look at the actual voting and approval of the president, to give you that. So I'm going to talk about the voting. In the 2010 election where the Republicans took 60-some seats in the House, very liberal voted Democratic, 90-some percent. Liberals, 85. Moderates, 73. In the 2014, so the same thing. So what happens is if the president is too liberal, they lose moderate votes. Mm-hmm. And without going into too many numbers, if you want them, I can do them. But if you look at the 2016 race, what really happened is Sanders supporters did not come out for Hillary in the end.
Right.
About various estimates, but I'd say between 16 and 20% mm-hmm. of Sanders voters in the primary did not vote for Mrs. Clinton, and that certainly hurt her. So now you have the Democratic Party, and what essentially happens is you got those percentages of liberals and moderates. Mm-hmm. Oh, I'll give you one other number. This is a YouGov economist poll that was taken before the South Carolina primary, okay? Mm-hmm. So that hasn't happened.
So
this happened
after Nevada, pre-South Carolina.
All that's happened is people have had time to think about the fact that Bernie Sanders is the leader, and many people think he can knock Biden out on Super Tuesday. So many people for the first time are thinking Bernie Sanders could be the nominee, okay? So in the latest poll, here's a very favorable opinion of Bernie Sanders, liberals. Very high, very liberal high. 27% of liberals have a high opinion of Sanders. 22% of moderates have a high opinion of him. Mm-hmm. So the bottom line is, given they had a week to think about it, or a little longer to think about it, the moderates and conservatives and the Democratic Party, not very many of them, but mainly moderates and the liberals mm-hmm. decided that's it.
Right.
And they went with Joe Biden big. And in California, where Sanders did the best. If you look at voters who decided in the last 2 days, mm-hmm. 48-21 Biden over Sanders.
Right.
In Texas, it's people who voted on election day, it's even more. So this was a gigantic swing. These people didn't think Joe Biden got more articulate. They didn't think he got smarter. Exactly what you said.
Right.
They saw him as you said in previous conversations.
So what about Band-Aid. So a thought about California, Dave, since that's what I live and swim in here at Hoover. It really is, in many regards, even more so after Super Tuesday, a political island unto itself in this regard. It was unique of the Super Tuesday states in that Bernie really never stopped campaigning here from 2016. He came out here for the June primary in 2016, and they didn't spend a lot of money on television, but they created a ground army, and they networked it and coalesced. They did a lot of it through Facebook and social media in 2016, but that army stayed intact. Bernie continued to come back to California between 2016 and 2020, still running basically. Yep. This time around, he had 20 field offices. I think Joe Biden had one in California, in East LA, but Bernie had 20 shops. He actually spent money advertising in California. You could see him barely because Bloomberg and Steyer hogged the airwaves, but Bernie was on TV. And I would also argue, Dave, between 2016 and 2020, California is swinging toward the Bernie way of the world. If you look at what the Democrats legislature want to do on health care, if you look at what Gavin Newsom talks about with things like, you know, universal preschool for four-year-olds and things like this, this is very much out of the Bernie ticket. So California is kind of taking on the democratic socialist thing in many aspects, and not a surprise that between that and also his support among Latinos that he would do well in California. Though I would note this, they're still counting ballots in California. Look, Brexit, I think, was decided on one day, and I think something like 30 or 32 million people went to the polls, and they could count the votes in one day. In California, for 9 to 10 million votes, it takes a month to figure it out, so we're doing something wrong. But I just want to point that out in California.
And the numbers, Scott, there are, mm-hmm. if you look at the very liberal category, California has around 30% say they're very liberal, and almost 40% say right. they're liberal. Mm-hmm. So if you look at the combination of those two, California is, by in the California Democratic Party,
right.
is in fact more liberal than the Democratic Party nationally, if you take the average.
Exactly. So I think you raised a very good point in that, you know, big difference between 2020 and 2016, Dave, was that 2016, from a very early point, was a binary choice for Democrats. It was either Hillary or Bernie. Yeah, a few other people ran for a president, but they were gone quick. They were afterthoughts, never more than a 2% presence. It was between these two, from Iowa to New Hampshire and on. In 2020, though, it's a very different race. You saw some of this play out on Super Tuesday in the form of Elizabeth Warren and Michael Bloomberg. Bloomberg won America's Samoa.
Yep.
I think a really good gig that you and I missed out on being Bert. He had seven people on the ground in America's Samoa to corral something like 175 votes to get five delegates. So I would like to be one of those ground people for working a month in America's Samoa. Good work if you can get it. But he didn't win any states. Warren didn't win any states. She finished third in her home state, which is pretty humiliating. But if you look at a state like Maine, if you look at Minnesota, if you look at your former state of Texas, she is getting 10 to 15% of the vote in these states, and we assume it chips into Bernie. But this is what interests me about the race here. It is the idea of Democrats coming home and settling on Biden. Some of this happens on the natural when Klobuchar steps out, when Buttigieg steps out. But what your data suggests is Democrats had this time. You consider that before Iowa, before Nevada, you had Iowa and New Hampshire. And Sanders basically ties in Iowa. We can argue forever who wins Iowa. We'll probably never know. He wins New Hampshire, but it's a squeaker. He basically underperforms versus his 2016 numbers. And the youth vote, let's talk about that in a minute. Yeah. The youth vote does not show up for him. So the revolution is not really in fact. But then Nevada happens. And that is eye-popping because he gets, what, 50% of the vote, some huge number. And now all of a sudden it looks like, yikes, the Democratic Party wants to nominate a Democratic Socialist. But you're telling me that somewhere in that week between Nevada and South Carolina, the Democrats thought, is this where we want to go? And that's when the getting behind Joe Biden begins.
Yeah, the moderates and the liberals, who generally on issues are closer to the moderates, mm-hmm. than they are to the very liberal.
Right.
So, and one way to think about it, when Representative Clyburn endorsed Biden in the South Carolina primary, I think the way to interpret that is that he knows Joe Biden, of course, but he looked out at the candidates and, you know, he's a member of the House leadership team, very important. Right. So he wants to pick someone who can win. So it's partly he knows him, but on the other hand, he wants to pick someone who can win. And if people listen to the whole speech, he took on the squad.
Mm-hmm.
He took on the very liberal part of the Democratic Party. He took on AOC. He took on those people. And he said things like, they never swung a district. They had nothing to do with the fact that we control the House of Representatives. We control the House of Representatives because we put reasonable candidates in. One other thing I would point out about what happens in this. So you look at the state of Montana, and the Governor Steve Bullock, who was a presidential candidate briefly, won Montana twice.
Right.
A good candidate for Montana. He would not say he was running for the Senate.
Right.
He came out yesterday and said, I will run for the Senate. And the reason he said he's going to run for the Senate is because it looks like Biden will be at the top of the ticket.
Right.
He knows, he knew that if Sanders was at the top of the ticket in Montana, bye-bye, no chance.
Right.
Now, Bert, so you're going to see in North Carolina and places like that, Democratic candidates who are more moderate have a better chance to win as long as they believe that Sanders is not at the top of the ticket. So stuff like this moves down, but essentially what Clyburn was saying was what all kinds of moderate and liberal Democrats were saying. If he's at the top of the ticket, it's over.
So Nancy Pelosi does not have a good night on Super Tuesday in that her California does not go to Biden, but she has a very good night on Super Tuesday in that Biden is now in a better position to get the nomination. Let me walk you through some math on this, Dave. So take a deep breath, have some water. This is going to take a second, but let's talk about what's ahead for the Democrats. So next Tuesday, you have six states going to the polls, Idaho, Michigan, Mississippi, Missouri, North Dakota, Washington, 349 delegates up for grabs on March the 10th, 1,357 just decided on Super Tuesday. A week after that, March 17th, St. Paddy's Day, four states vote, Arizona, Florida, Illinois, and Ohio. big states, interesting states geographically. Three of those states, Arizona, Florida, and Ohio, tie into the national election. Illinois, not so much. A week after that, Georgia votes, March 24th, 105 delegates there. March 29th, Puerto Rico, 51 delegates. Four states vote on April the 4th, Dave, 104 delegates in Alabama, Hawaii, Louisiana, Wyoming. Wisconsin votes on April the 7th, 84 delegates. Then April 28th, big day for the Democrats, 663 delegates in six states across America, Connecticut, Delaware, Maryland, Rhode Island, New York, and Pennsylvania, the big prizes that day. And things slow down very fast. Only
but
six
states. I think about 87 or 88% of the delegates at the April day.
Exactly, right? Because in May, all of six states vote in May, Indiana, Kansas, Kentucky, Nebraska, Oregon, West Virginia. 222 delegates vote on June the 2nd, Montana, New Mexico, South Dakota, New Jersey. That's where California ordinarily would be, but it's not because California just voted. This means, Dave, there are 32 states remaining, 2,465 pledged delegates sitting out here. Bernie won 14 of these 32 states in 2016, but he has a problem here. The biggest state remaining on the board that Bernie carried in 2016 is Wisconsin. With its 84 delegates, that's only the 11th largest state of all the states remaining. So there are 10 bigger states, and Hillary won all those in 2016. And you look at what states Bernie won that we're talking about here, these are mostly western states, Great Plains states, Alaska and Hawaii. They're, for the most part, small states. So he has a problem with delegates, but he has another problem, Dave, which is one of messaging. He has to go into Michigan next week and somehow rejigger his message against Joe Biden, but also make a stronger argument in favor of socialism. You look at your data. What can he say at this point?
I don't know. Well, he had an interesting commercial where he portrayed himself as one of Obama's best friends.
Yes.
Which...
Well, Biden did that. Michael Bloomberg did that up in down California. Everybody is Barack Obama's buddy.
Yeah, at this point. But in his case, it's not like... I don't know. The message is the revolution.
Right.
I don't think he has any other message. That's what it is. I think the only thing he can do is really work harder and try and get turnout up.
Yeah.
He did well with Latino voters in Nevada and in California, but those are essentially Mexican-American voters, did well with them. The only other state that has that high population is Arizona, because the New York and the Florida Latino populations are much different.
Right.
I don't see what his message can be other than this, we're on the ropes now.
Right.
I got to be the comeback kid, and the revolution has got to continue, and it can only continue if we win here, and hopefully the turnout among young people increases, possible. But that turnout among young people, for the 50 years I've been practicing political science, year after year, they don't turn out. They just don't turn out as much as people the largest turnouts, people 45 to 65, drops off a little at 65, but still there are many more people over 65 that turn out and vote than 18 to 29 percentages.
Which maybe is why he is now attacking Joe Biden on Social Security, claiming that he, Bernie Sanders, is the great defender of Social Security, and he, Joe Biden, has tried to cut Social Security.
Yeah, he has to go after Biden big time, and... you know, Biden's not a perfect candidate, but something you said, I think, before the show started, that Biden is think of Biden as a Band-Aid. Not everybody's saying, oh, God, he's the greatest candidate, but they're saying exactly what you meant by the Band-Aid. Perhaps I should let you speak it since you said it.
Well, maybe Band-Aid is a little too harsh. Let's call him maybe just sort of a acting temporary CEO of the party in this regard, that he is going to see it through a short period of time. Joe Biden turns 78, Dave, I think on November the 20th, which is 17 days after Election Day. A very young man.
Yeah.
We obviously have not elected a president of that age. Donald Trump is the current record holder. He was 70 in 2016. Reagan was 69 in 1980. So we're taking up another level if we elect a man who is just shy of 78 years old. So the presumption is when you're a 78-year-old president, you're probably a one-term act. It's something you don't talk about when you're running. I think you and I could go back and look through campaigns, Dave, and every candidate who has talked about being a one-term president, they've usually been in a world of hurt when they suggest that. Well, I'm just going to run for the one term and then I'll hand it over to somebody else. Yeah. It's just kind of a desperation message that you put out there. But Biden, in reality, probably is a one-term president, which means two things. First of all, his vice presidential pick becomes very, very important.
I agree.
Not because he necessarily is going to die in office, but because that person in a very short period of time will be
people are going to think of them as
be a very, very advantageous position to be the next president of the United States. But secondly, it's the question of what Joe Biden represents in terms of the evolution, the movement of the Democratic Party. You go back and look at John Kennedy in 1960, he's a transition. He's a 43-year-old man talking about a new frontier, and there's a certain new energy to the Democratic Party with Kennedy. Jimmy Carter is something very different in 1976. Bill Clinton runs as a, quote, different kind of Democrat in 1992. Barack Obama is certainly something very different for Democrats. But Joe Biden, well, he's been poking around national politics for over three decades. He is a fixture of Washington for over 40 years, almost 50 years now. There's nothing novel about Joe Biden. And his message, Dave, is simply a return to the status quo. This is something very new to Democrats, something they'll have to accept. So, Dave, how does Joe Biden get the Democratic Party electrified if basically he is running as comfort food?
I don't think he electrifies it. It's, as you said, the Democrats like the charismatic leaders who and policy wonks. Mm-hmm. I mean, Clinton was an ultimate policy wonk. Republicans don't tend to do that. George W. Bush was not a policy wonk. His dad knew a lot of stuff, but wasn't like that. And so who Democrats normally choose, that is not Joe Biden.
Right.
And the point then is I think they do see Democrats. I see nothing wrong with this. Democrats, the liberal and moderate Democrats, see Biden as someone who can beat Trump. That's mm-hmm. exceeding. You cannot keep out of your mind how important it is for Democrats to beat Trump. So when you say people are moderate or conservative, that doesn't mean they don't want to beat Trump. They do.
Right.
And so the fact is that Biden is for them acceptable. It's kind of a return to it'll be normal. There won't be all the tweets. There won't be all the jumping. It'll be steady Joe. We know what we got. Mm-hmm. We know what we get. He's not going to articulate. He's not going to sit there and do a spellbinding analysis of what the stock market and right. why it falls and why we have to do this. Not he's not Elizabeth Warren on any of that stuff, but he's acceptable to them. And therefore, I think your point is very important. He's acceptable. They don't see him as the future of the party. They see him as kind of the savior mm-hmm. against Trump. And then who's going to replace him then becomes exceedingly important.
Right. Your hunch as to what happens if he does something very surprising, for example, let's say Elizabeth Warren endorses him between now and the time of Michigan, and let's suppose that Joe Biden returns the favor by making her his vice presidential pick, which I think would surprise you and me. What does Elizabeth Warren get? Let's talk about her for a second because she dropped out of the race yesterday, and two things stand out to me. First of all, this conversation about women in politics, that she is a victim of the glass ceiling, her gender punished her. And then secondly, Dave, the sort of gap or the disconnect between reporters who love Elizabeth Warren. They just love them, an academic, white paper kind of candidate, versus voters who really didn't care for her at the end of the day. She did poorly in New Hampshire, which is rare for a Massachusetts politician. As I mentioned earlier, she finished third in her home state. So that breach between how reporters felt about the greatness of Elizabeth Warren versus the voters kind of seeing something
else. Well, look at the Biden won among women.
Right.
He was 10, 12 points among. So without women.
And didn't spend a dollar in Massachusetts.
No, it's over. Yeah. I mean, he is out, if that's not true. So, first of all, the women are not voting for her. Mm-hmm. Democratic women. This isn't a conservative Republican. These are Democratic women not voting for Elizabeth Warren. So I don't get that. But the press, you know, if you think about the debates, I think when I went back and did a quick look, the press, she did the best at almost every debate. She didn't lose any. And she won more than anybody else.
Right.
And that among the faithful, they sling money in. But so when she allegedly took out Bloomberg with that thing, what happened afterward?
Right.
She didn't do nothing. So when you track, so, you know, CNN, MSNBC, Fox, they got a lot of time to fill. Mm-hmm. And so sort of after South Carolina, what was there to say? Gee, a great victory for Biden. He did well here. Mm-hmm. Now we have to wait to see what happens on Super Tuesday.
Right.
But they got hours and hours to fill. So they fill it with that stuff. And they like the fact that she's smart and got all these plans, et cetera, et cetera. And but compared to Biden, I mean, people should pay very little attention to that because they just don't remember. I remember we tracked in the 2012 race, we were tracking statements. And remember Romney's famous 47%?
Yes.
So we tracked that. That people, oh, my God, that's going to cost in the election, blah, blah, blah. So we tracked it. A week after he said it, the number of people who remembered was about 50%, and the number of people who got right what he said was about 30%. 3 weeks later, about 12% of the people who, like you and I, who watch this stuff all the time, we remembered, but that was it. Those things just don't affect, and that's the reporters. They got time to fill,
right?
And they're not representative of the American people.
Yeah. If you had to ask me to describe Elizabeth Warren in this election, Dave, I think I would go with a bowling ball that picks up a 7-10 split, because she went to one corner and she took out Michael Bloomberg in that debate. And I think we can agree that that was the end of Michael Bloomberg. It was like watching the curtain get pulled back on the wizard.
He dropped from, in our poll, he dropped from about 18%. He'd risen to around 18%. He dropped to 11. Mm-hmm. And his electability went from 54 or so.
Yeah.
To 44.
Precipitous is the word I think we're looking at there.
And that was kind of unique, because normally you don't see the debates have that kind of an effect.
Right.
But this one did.
Well, that was interesting, especially with Bloomberg, because, look, he spends $500, who knows how much money he would have spent. I've seen $700 million. Then you toss in Tom Steyer, $250 million, with not a delegate to show. Money did not buy them a lot of success here, and that's curious, because these two ran, I thought, pretty effective ads during the primaries. If you looked at Bloomberg's ads, they pushed on what? They pushed on climate change. They pushed on gun control. And a lot of Bloomberg ads had him getting attaboys from one Barack Obama. So you look at that and you think, boy, this is a bona fide Democrat. He sees the world we do. You look at Tom Steyer's, and again, it's climate change. Now, the one thing Steyer does, he ran very hard on term limits, which I guess maybe there's pulling out there, but that just strikes me as such a Republican issue to take up. Yep. So I'm not sure the wisdom of that. But between them, the two billionaires spent maybe $1 billion of their own fortune, and they got nowhere fast. I find this actually very reassuring about our democracy, that this kind of hostile takeover got
pushed
back.
No, me too. I followed the California governor's election with Meg Whitman spending money. And toward the end of that, when we were polling, we had some people tell them, stop. Every time people see your commercial, what's going through their head is they're thinking she's trying to buy the election.
Yes.
And that it just set in. And it set in, I think it set in early on Bloomberg.
That's interesting.
And
there's sort of a point of saturation, a point of no returns when it comes to just killing people with ads. I think I've told you my anecdote of listening to him on my phone. I was listening to baseball games. His advertisers were relentless. You did want to scream at some point of hearing the Bloomberg ads.
Yeah, it's enough, and you know their opponents are going to say you're trying to buy the election, and so far all the examples I know it is reassuring.
Right. So Mike Bloomberg had a bad Super Tuesday. Steyer dropped out before Super Tuesday, so he saved himself the trouble of having a bad Super Tuesday. And somebody else who had a bad Super Tuesday, Dave, was California Senator Kamala Harris. And let me go off on her for a second. Kamala Harris, back in January, it was reported that she was going to endorse Biden. And this is before Iowa and before New Hampshire and Nevada, before Biden's much-celebrated problems in early February voting. But there she was, poised to endorse him, and this just all seemed very natural. Biden would then probably make her the running mate in November. And then she decided not to endorse him. For some reason, it didn't go through. And February came, and Biden struggled, and she did not endorse him. And then March came, Dave, after South Carolina, when Biden now is in a different position, and she still does not endorse him pre-California. The point of this being, if she had endorsed him in January, Dave, she would have done what Eric Garcetti, the mayor of Los Angeles and a co-chair of the Biden campaign, did, which was be there at the ready for Biden, maybe help with fundraising, but also Garcetti volunteering to go on the road. He was in Texas before Super Tuesday, helping work that state. It's a very different world, I think, for Kamala Harris if she makes that endorsement, Dave, and then spends her February out on the road campaigning for Biden in South Carolina and also getting on the ground here in California in Super Tuesday states. But she didn't do that. And so now she finds herself on the sidelines looking at this thing called the vice presidency. We chatted about this earlier. Do you think there's any way that Joe Biden will not put a woman on the ticket?
I think that...
I know it's a prediction call, but just reality, back to the reality of who he is, what kind of candidate.
I would say that for him to choose a woman would help him with the electorate. But it has to be... has to be the right woman. It has to be someone, because most of the time, the vice president, if you actually look hard at the data, it's vice presidents don't make much of a difference. They can maybe hurt you,
right?
But help you, no. The last time a candidate vice president helped was Lyndon Johnson, helped JFK carry Texas, which is necessary. But generally, they don't change votes. But in Biden's case, because of what we talked about, because he is a little younger than me, the question then becomes: well, you got to have somebody in the vice president who can take over. You have to believe it's on. So that has to be someone with some experience.
Right.
Harris had that. She's not only a woman; she's also black. Mm-hmm. And that would be a big help. But I don't think he's going to pick her now because she attacked him in the first debate and had a chance to come around to him and didn't do it in time. So I think you can explain Klobuchar's behavior in part by the fact that by getting in and immediately nominating Biden, she puts herself in a position to be there. So if you think about women, there's a lot of talk about Stacey
Abrams in Georgia.
But I think with Stacey Abrams, for moderates and conservatives in the Democratic Party, they were going to say, well, how does that reassure us that she knows what she's going to do, given she has never had any national? So I think I think it would behoove him, it would help him to have a woman in the election. But he's got to be very careful about who he picks, because it's got to be someone that exudes that confidence. Now, the Michigan governor and others around the country may be candidates here. The Michigan governor, by the way, endorsed, as you know, she endorsed Biden in the Michigan primary. So that'll probably help him in the primary. She's popular. So so we'll see. But I think he does have – I think it would help him to have a woman, but it has to be – someone who voters will say, okay, if something happens to Uncle Joe, we're okay.
Well, if you look at the Hoover Lane Center poll that came out just before Super Tuesday, we asked 1,500 Californians for their choice of a vice presidential pick. They picked Michelle Obama. Picked her by a big number, too. It was about 31%, and I believe Harris was the second pick at, I think, 19 or 18%. So they like them some FLOTUS.
Well, that shows why it would be useful to pick a woman. I think probably Michelle Obama would, very competent, obviously a usually competent person, but I don't know.
So it would be a little bit like the Palin, where everybody says, I'm comparing Sarah Palin to Michelle Obama. I'm not, but there would be a similar dynamic in this regard. When McCain picked Palin, there was a very jolting effect from this. It suddenly made the convention a lot easier, a lot more interesting to watch. She gave a very good acceptance speech at the convention.
Yes,
she did very well. Yep. And for a few days, she seemed just
kind of...
She boosted his ticket.
The data showed that she boosted it by a couple percent.
Right. It put energy into a ticket that wasn't quite there. Michelle Obama would have the same effect. She'd put a lot of energy in. It would seem to me, Joe, that Dave, the problem with putting Michelle Obama on the ticket would be this idea, you don't put somebody on the ticket who eclipses you at the end of the day.
Yeah, not only would she eclipse him in terms of being charismatic and energetic, et cetera, I think among some people they would say, okay, so she was first lady, but that's not politics. She's never run for anything, et cetera, et cetera. So Yeah, there would be a double whammy. I don't think. Yeah. My best guess is he would not pick her.
I think there's something Sherman-esque to the whole speculation. Yeah. I think if she were offered it, she would decline it. So doesn't want it. Let's close out here by talking about where the Democratic Party stands right now, Dave. 1972 keeps kind of dancing through my mind in this regard, in that it's not just to me, but McGovern year, and it looks like now the Democrats won't go with the next version of McGovern, which would be Bernie, in terms of a really perilous national candidate. But you look at the way the party itself is set up. Keep in mind, you go to a convention, it's not just who's going to be the nominee. Before the convention, there is what? There is a big discussion to be had over rules and platform. So one question about the Biden candidacy with Bernie in terms of how they strike peace, if there's going to be a peace to be made between them, is what goes into the planks of the Democratic Party. Yeah. You've watched the Democrats go through this with 72 with McGovern, because it wasn't just McGovern being the nominee. It was about what went into the party platform in terms of Vietnam and topics like this. You have seen the Democratic Party struggle through the 1980s with this issue about being too liberal. You saw Bill Clinton come along in 1992 and solve it by basically taking a lot of Ronald Reagan's planks on things like welfare and just cobbling them together for the Democrats. You then saw Democrats struggle again after Bill Clinton left, and then along came Barack Obama, who changed things. Now Obama's gone, and Democrats are again trying to figure out what to cobble together. Am I right here? Is there a parallel between 2020 and 1972 and just sort of this identity crisis Democrats have?
Well, I hadn't thought of it, but one point I think yes. What I was thinking of was the Democrats have a tendency to, so how did they get to proportional delegations? Why did they drop winner call? Well, Jesse Jackson, when he lost to Dukakis, that was what he wanted for peace.
Right.
Because if they'd have had that, he'd have gotten more delegates. So they did that. Then when Hillary won in 2016, Bernie said, oh, those super delegates, blah, blah, blah. So they changed the rules. So what I'm looking for is Perez, when he's going to appoint, as he will, who's going to chair the Democratic and the Policy Committee, does he have one person, a Biden appointee, chairing the platform committee, mm-hmm. or is it a double, and what kind of compromises do they make? And for me, I'm looking to see who the appointees are to run the convention, and the other part to the platform, and if he has, how far do they go to accommodate Bernie? And the first clue for me will be, who do they appoint to those positions?
Exactly, because going back to your data, look through your data and see, for example, where the Democrats are writ large on an issue like the Green New Deal. Bernie will want the Green New Deal put in the Democratic platform. If Joe Biden wants to win in the Midwest, he's got to scrap the Green New Deal. He has to find some way around that.
Yeah, you don't want to run in Pennsylvania on a platform that you're going to scrap fracking.
Correct.
Not a good idea.
Right. Then you take an issue, or let's say besides Green New Deal, health care. Are they going to put Medicare for all in the Democratic platform? No, they're going to go with Biden's modified single-payer option.
Yeah, so, exactly. Right. So, and who they appoint makes a difference. And I do think one other thing that people ought to think, the Biden campaign organization, you know this better than I, but was pretty creaky.
Yes.
But what's happened is Bloomberg and Buttigieg and others, some of the people, the Buttigieg people who are fundraisers, they're already in the Biden campaign. And Biden, in conversations with people, has apparently agreed to let people come in and run the campaign. So his campaign, I believe, will be smoother going out, which, by the way, will mean that Bernie will start, and he already has, started criticizing it for the money that's been put in. And apparently at a rally in Michigan last night, people started booing when Biden's name was mentioned.
Yes.
And he said, no, don't boo. Joe's a decent guy. He just got all the policies wrong. But that's not it's not a good, when you think down the line to the election, the fact that if Bernie Sanders supporters equal numbers or even close to the numbers that happened in 2016, the main difference will be the choice will not be between an unknown Donald Trump, as in 2016, and a known Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. So we'll see as we get along, if Biden gets the nomination, as we expect, we'll see where that goes and we'll have better numbers.
And then finally, let's talk a bit about the Bernie movement, if you will, the Democratic Socialist movement. So there is Bernie, who is even older than Joe Biden. So this is Bernie's second rodeo as a presidential candidate, and I would assume that's it. I couldn't, if the Democrats were to lose in 2020, it's hard to see Bernie doing this yet again in 2024. So you have Bernie at one extreme in terms of this, and someone like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez at the other extreme. She is in her, what, late 20s, I think. She is too young to run for the presidency. Where is
too young to be vice president.
Too young to be vice president. And also with redistricting, is looking about maybe having her district taken out from under her, which is a whole other topic. But what is the future of this party, of this movement, the Democratic Socialist movement, Dave, if you have a very old Bernie and maybe a very too green, pardon the pun, AOC? Who's in the middle to kind of carry the standard?
Depends if Biden wins. If Biden were to win the nomination and beat Trump, and pick somebody reasonable in the economy, then that wing goes kind of away. The same way the William Jennings Bryan or the populist movement dies out because the country is successful and
but
fades.
Yet you have this youth vote in the Democratic Party, which is not coming out in numbers, which Bernie thought the revolution is not as large as he thought it would, but yet you have young people who were part of the bread and butter of the Democratic existence in national elections and congressional elections. They're still there. They're getting a little older, but they believe them in some socialism. So you're going to have to find a way to appease them at the same time.
Well, the way to appease them is if things are functioning well and the economy is going well, they'll grow up. I'm sorry, I shouldn't say they'll grow up. They don't know much about socialism because they grew up in an era they didn't know anything about Russia, any of those things. So they'll grow up on that. But if Biden loses, if Biden gets the nomination and loses, then that movement and the squad takes on much more importance because they say, see, you did it again.
Yeah.
You did it again. You went for the moderate view again and you lost. If Bernie'd been nominated, he would have won. And then we'll see.
But empirically, there's nothing in your data to show that Bernie could win, because if Bernie could win, it would be based in theory of, my gosh, look at the turnout he's getting in the states. There is a
Win the nomination.
Yeah, to win the nomination, but also win the general election. You'd have to show me this groundswell of people, and the groundswell's not there.
Right. I agree on the data, but as you know better than I, over time, stuff could happen. The economy, Bernie's the alternative, and the economy's collapsed. We didn't do well handling COVID-19. So it would take an extreme set of circumstances for that to happen. But I do, as you pointed out at the beginning, want to remind us, in terms of humility, by the way, T.S. Eliot once said, the only kind of knowledge we can aspire to is humility.
Yeah.
Humility is endless. I want to point out that the three of us in 2016 clearly predicted that Hillary Clinton would be president. So we have to be very careful on that point.
But by the way, speaking of the three of us, one of us is not here today, and that's our colleague Doug Rivers, who, and this is a shout out to friend Doug, to his credit, to his enormous credit, while I was sitting here drinking the Kool-Aid about the open convention, Doug Rivers said, "Don't buy it."
I was waiting for Bill to pass the Kool-Aid.
So Doug, kudos to you. Hey, a final thought, Dave, and that is about the coronavirus. I don't know if there has been a presidential election affected by a pandemic. Let's see, the influenza was 1918, Wilson midterm. So we have not had an issue like this come down in presidential politics, and this seems to be cut in a lot of ways. Number one, it could potentially cut into people voting. If you think that people are just afraid to go out in the public, they're not going to want to go to a germy polling place on election day. But then second, it's just going to cut into news cycles. It's going to be the dominant news.
The economy is going to hurt.
I watch local news in California simply to find out, number one, if there's been a crime in my backyard, but also just because I'm curious as to what drives the news here, the old cliche, if it bleeds, it leads. Coronavirus dominates the news in California. Now, granted, we have the cruise ship off the coast, and we have a lot of international travel and affects our economy very much, but while we have all this political stuff going down, coronavirus is what has people's attention right now.
Yes.
So talk about that a bit as a growing element in this election, because it does come down to a question of the president's competency. Is his government doing a job?
When we ask questions about that, it's the president, when he first called it a hoax, and then back now they're treating it more seriously. But it did seem to inspire Democrats. First of all, Democrats, it fired them up more to say. And by the way, turn, as you understand, well, turnout in Iowa, New Hampshire was nothing spectacular, a little lower in Iowa. Turnout on Super Tuesday was quite high,
right,
especially in the suburbs. So turnout's back up. It seemed Democrats were fired up by over the question of what their presidential incompetence, it's a hoax, et cetera. So I think that matters. And the other thing among independents, which Trump won in 2016, independents, when we asked them about that, they were not happy with the president's performance on that. So mm-hmm. now it'll happen what we do and what happens, whether the performance is good or not. But he certainly did not get himself off on a good foot by calling it a hoax and then now saying it's serious.
Right. So this is a problem for Donald Trump on a couple of fronts. Number one, it's a question of his management, which is not what Trump wants to have a conversation about in November. He wants to have a conversation about the economy,
yep,
about things going in a positive direction, which yeah. then ties into coronavirus. Because if you are an investor, yep. you got whiplash this week watching the market go up 1,200 points and go down 1,200 yeah. points. So it's running for reelection in a time of volatility, which I don't think any incumbent wants to do.
I agree. Absolutely. So it can. It absolutely can affect things.
Okay. So your thoughts just on the course of this race right now. Do you think we're just kind of locked into an inevitable outcome now? I know you don't like the crystal ball, but absent Bernie doing something remarkable or absent Joe Biden committing, heaven knows what kind of gaffe. There is a debate on March the 15th in Phoenix. So that's maybe if Bernie doesn't have a March 10th, that's probably Bernie's last stand. The hope that Biden does something tragically wrong in that debate and somehow that spills over into Ohio maybe two days later.
Biden in the debate, I think he can do well if he, and I hope he got the R's who are saying, I think he can do well by just saying, you know, if you want somebody who will stand and point at you and tell you constantly you're wrong,
yeah.
or a great debater, I'm not your guy. But if you want somebody who will listen to you and try and get something done, I'm your guy.
Right.
And so I think in the debate, if he can just take, and I think he'll probably move in that way, I think he'll stand better. So I do think Biden will win the nomination. But if you would have asked us a week ago, and we had one of these, mm-hmm. thank God you didn't ask it. If you would have said, in 1 week, we're going to have a special show on Friday because it looks like the nomination is over.
Right.
We would have, fortunately, we would not have agreed with that probably.
Exactly.
So my crystal ball is very cloudy.
Well, we can agree this is
somebody poured coffee in.
Pretty remarkable turnaround for
yes.
a race and one politician in the
yep.
course of 72 to 96
yep.
hours for Biden to go from, you know, largely written off to now largely written in for the nomination.
Absolutely. He went from after the primary, he fell to like 51% electability.
Right.
And in the week and before South Carolina, he was back up at 68%, and he went from 20% of the electorate to 31%, and Sanders fell from 30% mm-hmm. to 24%.
Right.
And this was before South Carolina, mm-hmm. before the endorsement.
Yeah, and somewhere Jeb Bush and Rudy Giuliani are thinking, you know, this is what we had lined up.
Yes.
We were going to do poorly in the first couple states, but then South Carolina or Florida were going to turn
yep.
things around for us.
Yep.
So it can be done. That's the lesson.
It can be.
Okay. Dave Brady enjoyed the talk.
Same here. Thanks, Bill.
You've been listening to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast on the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. In this podcast, it was Democrats looking to face Mr. Trump in November, which seems increasingly so Joe Biden. If you've been enjoying Area 45, please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to us and tell your friends all about us. Get them to have a listen. You can find the Hoover Institution online at www.hoover.org. And while you're there, do yourself a favor and sign up for the Hoover Daily Report, which delivers the best work of Dave Brady and Doug Rivers and their Hoover colleagues to your inbox weekdays. The Hoover Institution has Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter feeds. Our Twitter handle is @HooverInst. That's @HooverInst. Dave Brady is not on social media, nor do I think he ever will be, unless somebody sets it up as a joke at his expense. However, our colleague who's not here today, Doug Rivers, is. His Twitter is @Doug_Rivers. That's @Doug_Rivers. Rivers, but expect it. Doug also polls for YouGov, the great internet polling company. YouGov's Twitter handle is @YouGov. That's YOUGOV, YouGov. Go check it out. For the Hoover Institution, this is Bill Whalen. We'll be back soon with another installment of Area 45. Until then, take care. Thanks for listening.
For more podcasts from the Hoover Institution, please visit hoover.org or Hoover's channels on iTunes, iTunes U, Stitcher, and SoundCloud. I'm Chris Dauer for the Hoover Institution. Thanks for listening.